Babylon, yeah. You queen of my fallen, jumping down at Rahab, Ethiopia calling. I hear a call in mystery Babylon. Your queen of my fallen, down to the ground and Rahab, Ethiopia. Your queen of my home, it's tumbling down and rehab, Ethiopia. I hear her calling mystery Babylon. Your queen of my home, tumbling down and rehab, Ethiopia is calling. Send my sons and daughters back home.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's debate is, should universal health coverage be the U.S. federal government's responsibility? And now, back to the debate.
In making her 2-minute summary against the motion, Sally Pipes.
Although it would be nice if the federal government could solve all of our health care challenges, current events both at home and abroad show that it cannot. As a Canadian, I watched firsthand the promise of free health care, and I saw it devolve into the reality of a high tax bill and long lines for advanced care. As waiting lists grew over the years to more than 4 months in 2007, an increasing number of Canadians have traveled to the United States for treatment and paid out of pocket, whether it's Mayo's, the Cleveland Clinic, or UCSF system. The number of illegal private clinics in Canada has grown significantly over the last few years. The government is afraid to shut them down, even though private health care is illegal in Canada, for fear of an immense outcry. In June 2005, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled in a monumental decision that the ban on private health care in Quebec is illegal. Quebecers are entitled to life, liberty, and the security of the person. Long waiting lists do not give you that security. Claude Castonguay, chair of a Quebec Royal Commission on Health Care in the 1960s, recommended that Quebec adopt government health care. The Quebec government followed his advice, and they called him the father of Quebec Medicare, just like Tommy Douglas, the father of Medicare. This year, he released a report, an official government report, evaluating Quebec's ailing health care system. His conclusion, it's in crisis. He now urges legalization of private health insurance. Americans believe in freedom and personal responsibility, not big government. They don't want big government controlling our lives. The question is, who do you want to control your health care decisions? An HMO bureaucrat, a government bureaucrat, or you yourself?
We're next going to hear from Michael Rackless. Michael Rackless is a physician and health policy analyst, the author of Prescription for Excellence, How Innovation is Saving Canada's Healthcare System. Michael, your 2 minutes begin now.
Yes, I want to mention that the waiting list issue, I mentioned that it is a problem in Canada, but other countries with universal systems don't have waiting list problems. It is not a problem of universal coverage. And in fact, in Toronto right now, because of public response to the concerns about waiting lists, if you need cataract surgery, if you need your knee replaced, if you need a hip replaced, phone one number, you can be seen in an assessment clinic within 1 week usually, and you can get your surgery within a month after that. And it doesn't cost you any money directly because you pay it in your taxes. And the taxes in Canada as a share of GDP are almost as low as they are in the United States, and we've had surpluses for 11 years. I think what you're hearing from the other side are a whole series of anecdotes, and yet the overall research indicates that every other wealthy country in the world where you would feel comfortable visiting and living has universal system. And I think what you really have to watch out for is what the New Yorker commented on April 20th, 1992, referring to then the first President Bush. The compulsion that drives President Bush to distort the facts about Canadian healthcare suggests that official American policy is in the process of becoming what conservatives in discussing the Soviet Union used to call a total ideology. A system blindly convinced of its absolute truth and yet so fragile in its relationship to reality that it is incapable of considering even the most obvious reform. Surely we should have learned by now what happens to ideological systems that begin to deny facts that their people can discover for themselves just by crossing a border.
Michael Rackless summing up for the proposition. Summing up against the proposition, Michael Cannon, co-author of Healthy Competition, What's Holding Back Healthcare and How to Free It. He is the Cato Institute's Director of Health Policy Studies. Michael?
At the reception before we came in here, I was standing across from a man who was reading his program, and when he came to the part with my picture on it, he looked at the picture, he looked up at me, and he said, "Hey, that's you. You're against universal coverage?" Because I think, and this look came over his face, the question that was forming was something like, what kind of a moral reprobate could be against universal health insurance coverage? And I know that I have a lot of family here tonight who are asking themselves the same question. My opposition stems from two beliefs. One is that people should have the right to choose their doctor, they should have the right to choose their health plan, and those things are often lost in systems of universal coverage, almost uniformly. No, I think totally lost. And second, universal coverage is not going to make us healthier. We have serious problems here in the United States with rising costs, with low quality care, and we have health plans in the private sector that are trying to innovate with ways to reduce those costs and to improve the quality of care. The only problem is you can't choose them because the government has said you can't. You can have a healthcare sector that guarantees universal coverage, or you can have a healthcare sector that continuously makes medical care better, cheaper, and safer, making it easier to deliver on that moral obligation that we have to help the less fortunate among us. You cannot have both.
Thank you, Michael Cannon. Art Kellerman is an ER doctor at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta and a professor at Emory. Summing up for the motion, universal health coverage should be the federal government's responsibility. Dr. Art Kellerman.
Have you all heard the expression that there are no atheists in foxholes? I can tell you, in my experience, there are no libertarians in intensive care units. It's widely said that Americans can pick their doctor. The fact of the matter is, if you're in a non-group plan or you're in a plan that doesn't contract with these doctors over here, but you can over here, every day I see patients whose care is disrupted because their plan has shifted doctors, they didn't get the deal they wanted. We've surrendered an enormous amount of freedom in this country to the private insurance industry and to the rest of the industry. We can collectively together do better. In just a few moments, you're going to vote again. And the six of us care a lot about how that vote turns out. But that's really not the vote that matters. The vote that matters is coming up on November the 4th. And I encourage every one of you to do your homework and do your homework on the candidates' positions on health care, because they are strikingly different and they, to some degree, break down along the lines of the debate tonight. And it should make a difference in the choice that you make then as well as the choice you make tonight. I want to close by going back to the bedside of that family. I didn't tell that mother the whole truth that night. But by staying silent and withholding the truth, I left her with something we both needed, which is hope. Hope that her son would beat the odds. Sometimes we see young people come back from catastrophic injuries and do okay. And most important, hope that this great nation of ours, the United States of America, will soon finally do the right thing and cover the uninsured, so no mother need ever ask again, will my son get the care he needs? Please vote for tonight's resolution.
And now to the results. Question of who won the room. Before the debate, 49% were for the motion, 24% were against, 27% were undecided. Now, after the debate, after hearing the arguments and voting, 58% of you are for the motion, 34% against, 8% undecided. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us this evening.
I'm John Donvan, your host and moderator, and the applause you hear was actually for both sides in this debate because in terms of sheer numbers, the majority of the audience came into the debate supporting the side for the motion, and that was true afterwards. However, in terms of persuasion, the side against the motion managed to change more minds throughout the evening. Their support went up 10%. While the side for the proposition went up 9%, a mere 1% difference. So congratulations to both sides.
Hear great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
My worries seem so small, but for my one love fall, I can see my rainbow calling through the misty breeze of my waterfall. Some people say they think the fall of the lazy man is fool with nothing left to lose. So let them laugh at me. So just as long as I have you. This is what I'm gonna do. I have nothing to lose. As long as I have you down. Yeah.
Up next, Lyndon B. Johnson with his We Shall Overcome speech. It was made on March 15, 1965, a week after deadly racial violence had erupted in Selma, Alabama, as Americans were attacked by police while preparing to march to Montgomery to protest voting rights discrimination. That discrimination took the form of literacy, knowledge, or character tests administered solely to African Americans to keep them from ever registering to vote. Lyndon Baines Johnson was the 36th President of the United States.
President Hatcher, Governor Romney, Senators McNamara and Hart, Congressman Meader and Stabler, and other members of the fine Michigan delegation, members of the graduating class, my fellow Americans. It is a great pleasure to be here today. This university has been coeducational since 1870, but I do not believe it was on the basis of your accomplishment that a Detroit high school girl said, and I quote, "In choosing a college, you first have to decide whether you want a coeducational school or an educational school." Well, we can find both here at Michigan, although perhaps at different hours. I came out here today very anxious to meet the Michigan student whose father told a friend of mine that his son's education had been a real value. It stopped his mother from bragging about him. I have come today from the turmoil of your capital to the tranquility of your campus to speak about the future of your country. The purpose of protecting the life of our nation and preserving the liberty of our citizens is to pursue the happiness of our people. Our success in that pursuit is the test of our success as a nation. For a century, we labored to settle and to subdue a continent. For half a century, we called upon unbounded invention and untiring energy to create an order of plenty for all of our people. The challenge of the next half century is whether we have the wisdom to use that wealth to enrich and elevate our national life and to advance the quality of our American civilization. Your imagination and your initiative and your indignation will determine whether we build a society where progress is the servant of our need, or a society where old values and new vision are buried under unbridled growth. For in your time, we have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the great society. The great society rests on abundance and liberty for all. It demands an end to poverty and racial injustice, to which we're totally committed in our time. But that is just the beginning. The great society is a place where every child can find knowledge to enrich his mind and to enlarge his talent. It is a place where leisure is a welcome chance to build and reflect, not a feared cause of boredom and restlessness. It is a place where the city of man serves not only the needs of the body and the demands of commerce, but the desire for beauty and the hunger for community. It is a place where man can renew contact with nature. It is a place which honors creation for its own sake and for what it adds to the understanding of the race. It is a place where men are more concerned with the quality of their gold than the quantity of their good. But most of all, the great society is not a safe harbor, a resting place, a final objective, a finished work. It is a challenge constantly renewed, beckoning us toward a destiny where the meaning of our lives matches the marvelous product of our labor. So I want to talk to you today about three places where we begin to build the great society: in our cities, in our countryside, and in our classroom. Many of you will live to see the day, perhaps 50 years from now, when there will be 400 million Americans, four-fifths of them in urban areas. In the remainder of this century, urban population will double, city land will double, and we will have to build homes and highways and facilities equal to all those built since this country was first settled. So in the next 40 years, we must rebuild the entire urban United States. Aristotle said, "Men come together in cities in order to live, but they remain together in order to live the good life." It is harder and harder to live the good life in American cities today. The catalog of ills is long. There is the decay of the centers and the despoiling of the suburbs. There's not enough housing for our people or transportation for our traffic. Open land is vanishing and old landmarks are violated. Worst of all, expansion is eroding these precious and time-honored values of community with neighbors and communion with nature. The loss of these values breeds loneliness and boredom and indifference. And our society will never be great until our cities are great. Today, the frontier frontier of imagination and innovation is inside those cities and not beyond their borders. New experiments are already going on. It will be the task of your generation to make the American city a place where future generations will come not only to live, but to live the good life. And I understand that if I stayed here tonight, I would see that Michigan students are really doing their best to live the good life. This is the place where the Peace Corps was started. It is inspiring to see how all of you, while you're in this country, are trying so hard to live at the level of the people. A second place where we begin to build the great society is in our countryside. We have always prided ourselves on being not only America the strong and America the free, but America the beautiful. Today, that beauty is in danger. The water we drink, the food we eat, the very air that we breathe are threatened with pollution. Our parks are overcrowded. Our seashores overburden. Green fields and dense forests are disappearing. A few years ago, we were greatly concerned about the ugly American. Today, we must act to prevent an ugly America. For once the battle is lost, once our natural splendor is destroyed, it can never be recaptured. And once man can no longer walk with beauty or wonder at nature, his spirit will wither and his sustenance be wasted. A third place to build the great society is in the classrooms of America. There your children's lives will be shaped. Our society will not be great until every young mind is set free to scan the farthest reaches of thought and imagination. We are still far from that goal. Today, 8 million adult Americans, more than the entire population of Michigan, have not finished 5 years of school. Nearly 20 million have not finished 8 years of school. Nearly 54 million, more than one quarter of all America, have not even finished high school. Each year, more than 100,000 high school graduates with proved ability do not enter college because they cannot afford it. And if we cannot educate today's youth, what will we do in 1970 when elementary school enrollment will be 5 million greater than 1960? And high school enrollment will rise by 5 million and college enrollment will increase by more than 3 million. In many places, classrooms are overcrowded and curricula are outdated. Most of our qualified teachers are underpaid and many of our paid teachers are unqualified. So we must give every child a place to sit and a teacher to learn from. Poverty must not be a bar to learning, and learning must offer an escape from poverty. But more classrooms and more teachers are not enough. We must seek an educational system which grows in excellence as it grows in size. And this means better training for our teachers. It means preparing youth to enjoy their hours of leisure as well as their hours of labor. It means exploring new techniques of teaching to find new ways to stimulate the love of learning and the capacity for creation. These are three of the central issues of the great society. While our government has many programs directed at those issues, I do not pretend that we have the full answer to those problems. But I do promise this. We are going to assemble the best thought and the broadest knowledge from all over the world to find those answers for America. I intend to establish working groups to prepare a series of White House conferences and meetings on the cities, on natural beauty, on the quality of education, and on other emerging challenges. And from these meetings and from this inspiration and from these studies, we will begin to set our course toward the great society. The solution to these problems not rest on a massive program in Washington, nor can it rely solely on the strained resources of local authority. They require us to create new concepts of cooperation, a creative federalism between the national capital and the leaders of local community. Woodrow Wilson once wrote, "Every man sent out from his university should be a man of his nation as well as a man of his time." Within your lifetime, powerful forces already loose will take us toward a way of life beyond the realm of our experience, almost beyond the bounds of our imagination. For better or for worse, your generation has been appointed by history to deal with those problems and to lead America toward a new age. You have the chance never before afforded to any people in any age. You can help build a society where the demands of morality and the needs of the spirit can be realized in the life of the nation. So will you join in the battle to give every citizen the full equality which God enjoins and the law requires, whatever his belief or race or the color of his skin? Will you join in the battle to give every citizen an escape from the crushing weight of poverty? Will you join in the battle to make it possible for all nations to live in enduring peace as neighbors and not as mortal enemies? Will you join in the battle to build the great society, to prove that our material progress is only the foundation on which we will build a richer life of mind and spirit? There are those timid souls that say this battle cannot be won, that we are condemned to a soulless wealth. I do not agree. We have the power to shape the civilization that we want, but we need your will and your labor and your hearts if we are to build that kind of society. Those who came to this land sought to build more than just a new country. They sought a new world. So I have come here today to your campus, say that you can make their vision our reality. So let us, from this moment, begin our work so that in the future men will look back and say, it was then, after a long and weary way, that man turned the exploits of his genius to the full enrichment of his life. Thank you. Goodbye.
That's all, folks.